Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna, and this is Hyphenated, the podcast about living in the hyphen. Today I am joined by a very, very good friend of mine, Daniel Povenmire, which I've never, ever called him Daniel in my life. His name is Dan. Dan is an American voice actor, animator, director, writer, producer, storyboard artist, like literally everything to do with animation he's done. He's the creator of Phineas and Ferb, and actually me and him are working together on his new show. Dan, welcome to Hyphenated. I can't believe it. Look at us. Who would have thought?
I'm assuming somebody dropped out at the last minute.
Because here's the thing. People always freak out online when they realize I know you, because you're also a big TikTok star and a big everything star, especially to people that are a little bit younger than me who grew up watching Phineas and Ferb.
To the 13 to 24 demographic, I'm weirdly a celebrity, yes, now. I'm like the father figure for different generations.
Me and you met very weirdly, and I think that people are always shocked when I post something online with you or when we do something together.
They're like, how do you know him?
Yes, like, how did this Venezuelan comedian meet the creator of Phineas and Ferb, and how are they working together on a show? Like, what the fuck is happening?
Yes. Well, I think I purposely made it happen, right?
It was you.
Because my wife and I, my wife is from Venezuela. You do a lot of Venezuelan humor in your thing. We were laughing out loud at the things that happen to you if you're Venezuelan in this country, and one of them was everybody thinks you're from Minnesota, and we just laughed because of how many times people have said, you know, like, and she'd say, I'm from Venezuela. Oh, Minnesota. I didn't really. And we were laughing, and I just started watching your videos, and I loved them, and I just think you're quite brilliant, and I said, I'm gonna comment on our video and just tell her I'm a big fan and that we love it because I'm married to a Venezuelan, and I think I just said, hey, I love your stuff. My wife's Venezuelan. If you're ever in town in LA, send me a note and we'll have lunch.
Well, I was like, this is weird.
Yeah.
But I can't just assume this is fake.
Yeah.
And I was talking to my Venezuelan friend. I was like, I got this weird email from this guy that claims he's married to a Venezuelan. And it's this guy who created Phineas and Ferb. I don't think he would email me. This feels fake.
Yes.
And she was like, no, Dan. Dan is married to my cousin. Yeah, he's great. He's real. And So I went to LA and I emailed you back and we were going to meet up. And I think we were going to meet up at your house and then drive from there to a restaurant.
Yes.
And in the Uber, I told the Uber, I was like, I'm driving to a man's house that I don't know is that man. And also, I don't know his deal and I'm scared. Can you stay here until he opens the door?
Yes.
And you make sure it's him. Like, he looks like his Wikipedia page.
Yeah.
And you open the door and, you know, there was like pictures of Gladdy and the kids and all this stuff. And I was like, oh, this guy's legit. And then we started a friendship from there. That was what, like 6 or 7 years ago?
Yes.
I risked my life.
Yes.
And then 6 or 7 years later, I got a job. And now I'm the story editor of your new show.
Yes, Hamster and Gretel.
Really?
You're like my second in command.
And all because I responded to a weird email.
And came out and had Venezuelan food with me in Pasadena.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
And I remember in that first conversation, we sort of talked a bit about your career. And for me, I was kind of flabbergasted because I knew you created Phineas and Ferb, and like, that's like a seminal show. It definitely made its impact on many generations because the parents of of kids are obsessed with it, and
yeah.
I'm now friends with parents instead of kids.
You're in this weird dark area of age group where a lot of people don't really have any relationship with Phineas and Ferb, because people who are like 5 or 10 years older than you were the parents of kids who were going through the Phineas and Ferb phase. So it's like once you get to like 40, the people over 40 all know the show. The people under like 27, 28 all know the show. But there's this like the early 30s is like this crowd that we sort of missed because they were in like in late high school or early college when the show peaked.
But the show is like, is it the biggest Disney Channel show in history, or
definitely their biggest animated show? I think somebody sent me something that said that it was the biggest one. You know, because animated shows have a longer shelf life than Hannah Montana. You know, the people aren't rewatching Hannah Montana as feverishly as they're rewatching Phineas and Ferb because animated shows don't seem to age in the same way.
Right. And there's also like visually, like even fashion choices.
Right. Yes. It doesn't have that same problem. You don't have haircuts that you go, oh, when was that in fashion? You know, so it's probably certainly up there. It's the biggest animated hit by far that they've ever had.
I think a lot of it is also because it didn't just appeal to kids. There was an appeal to adults, and kind of what we try and do on our show.
Yeah. You try to throw as many jokes as you can in and don't ever censor one because you think it's too smart. Is what, you know, and I had to answer that question early on at Disney on Phineas. I would get this note that would say, okay, that's a funny joke, but is our audience even going to get it? And I'd say, I don't care. As long as it doesn't make your audience change the channel, there's another joke coming for the kids in 5 seconds. Trust me on this. We're playing to the adults in the room. And they were like, okay, like that. And then, you know, 44% of our audience was adults, either with or without kids. And they shut up about that, once the show became super successful. But I think you need to not pigeonhole your show for just one demographic. I think that's where you limit the appeal for even that demographic, because there's a lot of kids who loved the more esoteric and older gags in the show, and you know, those are the ones that stick. And also, they're going to watch it again when they're in high school. They're going to watch it again when they're in college, and they're going to get jokes they didn't get the first time through.
Yeah, it like matures like a wine.
Yes.
You know? Except you can't have wine as a child, so that was a terrible metaphor. But so you worked for years as multiple things on multiple animated shows.
Yes.
Animated shows that I grew up watching, and it freaked me out to know you worked on these shows.
Yeah, you didn't know a lot of my resume until we had been friends for a while, and then I would mention something, you went like, oh my god, you worked on what was like Hey Arnold.
I loved Hey Arnold.
Or Rocko's Modern Life, or one of those early Nickelodeon shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very lucky. I had I've had friends that have had to work on The Care Bears, and these animated shows that they didn't feel like a part of. They were just part of a machine that was selling toys and stuff like that. And I was a part of a lot of machines that were selling toys, but they were because they were, you know, I was on The Simpsons and Rocko's Modern Life and Hey Arnold and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and SpongeBob SquarePants and Family Guy.
Like, that's a huge one that you were on. You were a director on Family Guy for a very long time.
I was director and storyboard supervisor on Family Guy through like season 6, I guess. So that was a great gig. I would not have left if I hadn't sold my own show, because I was getting paid primetime money, but also because I was storyboard supervisor, which was a position they had just made up for me because Seth wanted to give me sections of anybody else's show that he wanted to do, because because he realized, oh, if I write a musical number or if I have a bunch of visual gags that I just want, I could sit in the writer's room for 2 hours and come up with a bunch of stuff, or I could just give it to Dan and he's going to do the same thing and I won't have to worry about it again.
Mm-hmm.
So he would give me those kind of sections, or he would do a big musical number and say, okay, we'll just do, we're just going to write the lyrics and the music and we'll give it to Dan and he'll fill it, you know, and that's what, how Shapoopy happened. And that's how Fellas of the freaking FCC happened. But I could literally go into any script. If I read a script that I liked a section of it, I could go and say, okay, I'm going to take this. And I would take that section and I would board it. And it was like, I got all the fun.
Which was a great gig.
It was a great gig. I was the only person on the art staff that was also sort of considered a writer. Seth used to call me the 13th writer. So I had a lot more creative freedom than sort of anybody on that side of the show. And it was a dream job. I only left because I sold my own show and I gotta go. And then later Seth offered me a lot to come back and he, at a party. He was like, what if I made you executive producer, gave you an executive producer title? And I was like, oh, that would be more than I'm making now. And he said, and I could give you like 40 hours a year on my jet. And I was like, oh, and suddenly I was going through my brain. It's like, that means we could go to Aruba every Christmas like we do and not have to go through a metal detector and not have to be there at a certain time. I could just call up and say, can you have the jet gassed up? We'll be there around between 4 and 5. And I was like, a private jet for like the whole family? I think I still have to say no.
Sounds like a gag. Like, here's my firstborn child.
But that was the first time I really like went, oh, I really had to think about it.
And you didn't know Phineas and Ferb was going to be a hit.
No, at the time I did not. The thing is, like when I left Family Guy to go to Phineas and Ferb, I had taken $1,000 a week cut in pay to run my own show. But it was my own show.
Significantly more work, correct?
Significantly more work, but I got to make all the decisions. You know, it's like me and Swampy created the show together and we just did everything the way we wanted to do it.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
So this is the first show I've worked on that's animated, and I didn't know all of the different positions within the animated space. And once I did, once I found out that, you know, there's the designers, the ones that like create the visual aesthetic of the world. Then there's the storyboard artists who aren't the animators. They sort of direct and draw out the scene.
They figure out where the camera is, and in quotes, and what the characters do in that space, and they stage it and they block it, and they do most of the work that a live action director would do.
And then you send out this thing to overseas to some other, you know, company.
Yeah, with directions of what to put on every single frame in between the drawings that we send them.
And they're the animators.
Yes, they're considered the animators. If we do action or something we want to look a very specific way, we'll send all the animation poses and we'll give them in-betweens to do. But if it's just a dialogue scene or something like that, they'll put all the mouth movements in and stuff. I always say that, like, you'll draw the wind-up and the end of the pitch, and they'll draw the drawings in between. You know, like they'll draw the hand coming forward for 4 frames and letting go of the ball for 2 frames. And so we just try to give them enough information that they're really just going from one drawing to the next and doing a certain number of in-betweens, and then we tell them how many in-betweens we want there.
I think what's really interesting is I'm a career multi-hyphenate outside of this world. Like, oh, I'm a writer. I've written for animation and I've written for live action and I'm an actor.
And you're a voice actor and you're an internet star.
But you're multi-hyphenate. To see it every day at work is sort of like mind-blowing, because you draw, you write, then you direct, but then you also voice act. Oh, and you also write the music of the show.
Well, I write the songs.
But there's so many elements to animation that are just beyond my wheelhouse.
Yes.
That I see something animated and I'm like, why is this weird? It's not working. And then yes. You will come in and you'll just be like, oh, the camera's in the wrong direction. She's too small in comparison to the building and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, animation is very, very frame specific. There was a gag on Family Guy where Brian and Stewie are hot wiring a car, and it was funny in the table read, so I knew it was a funny gag. Mm-hmm. And we sat in the editing room and just moved things back and forth, four frames here, three frames there, like this, trying to get this one gag to work where Stewie hotwires the car, and when it comes on, there's a song on the radio. And Brian turns it off immediately, and Stewie pops his head up and says, "Ooh, put it back, I like that song." And I thought it was really funny in the table read, so I knew it was funny in the script, and it was just not funny in the animatic. And we we spent like 20 minutes just moving things around there and stuff. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to try one more thing. I want you to take a frame out here and put two frames there. It was like literally that much. It's less than a 12th of a second difference on either side.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we played that, everybody in the editing room laughed.
Mm-hmm.
And like people were editing other acts at the time, stopped and went, well, it's funny now. What did you do? And I said, that was one frame out of here and two frames put there. It's like, that's how delicate those things are. And it's easy to sort of give up on it. I think it's always worth the effort to do the cut until it feels right to you there.
I think what you just said is really interesting, because timing is pretty much everything when it comes to comedy. And in animation, timing is everything but on steroids.
Yes, yes.
Every millisecond can make or break something.
I had a writer on Phineas, named John Barry, who wrote, you know, who came from like writing plays and stuff like that. He would write sketch comedy and things like that. And he would come into the editing room and we'd get stuff back in color, and he would watch and go, oh, that's not working. And he would get his notebook out and he would be starting to rewrite that line.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, no, hold on. And then I would like take a pause out here and add a pause there. You know, I would just move things around timing wise. And play it back, and it would work perfectly. And he'd go, oh, I would never have thought that was a fixable gag, because I heard it and it wasn't funny to me. So I felt like, oh, I need to do another gag there. And it was literally just sliding something a couple frames this way, and suddenly it worked. And it sort of opened up his brains like, oh, we can do that here, which we really can't do in live action. We can make something work when it's not working, by just changing the performance just a little bit.
Which I think one thing that has shocked me working on our show, Hamster and Gretel, is how meticulous the making of each episode is, and how many iterations of each episode we are a part of. Like, I had never been on a show where, you know, we write the script. There's like three versions of the script. We finally end on the script. We were like, okay, this is a good script. Then we send it to the storyboard artist who give us a thematic, which is just a very simplified version of what the episode would look like. And then a lot of time we're like, oh my God, this isn't working. And we have to rewrite it.
Yes.
And then we send it back.
Exactly.
And then we get another version.
Yeah.
And then we're like, oh God, we got to rewrite these seven jokes. And then we send it back. And then, and it's just like every 11 minutes goes through an insane amount of work.
And you see it over and over again. When I was on The Simpsons, I noticed that when shows would go through animatic the first pass and would be really, really funny, they would often be less funny by the time they went on the air. Because on The Simpsons, they had time set to rewrite about 20% of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And they would get to that point and say, okay, what are the least funny of these funny, funny gags? And let's rewrite them and try to get them all up to the same thing. And they would often come up with stuff that wasn't as funny, but it was newer to them, so it sounded funny.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had already heard these other jokes several times. And that's the thing I'm always wrestling with in the editing room on any of my shows, on Phineas and on Milo Murphy and now on Hamster and Gretel, is, okay, I've heard this gag a bunch of times. Is that why it's not funny to me, or is it actually not funny? You don't want to rewrite stuff because you have the time to rewrite it. And a lot of times I have to go, okay, the first 5 or 6 times or 12 times I heard this gag, it made me laugh. I haven't changed it since then. I sort of have to believe that it's working now.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the best way to find out is to show it to a group of people who haven't seen it 22 times. But sometimes you don't have that luxury. Like, most of the Phineas and Ferb shows did not make me laugh by the time I was done with them. I was sick of them.
Mm-hmm.
I hated the show quite often.
You hated the show?
By the time I got rid of them. And I just didn't want to see them anymore. And so to me, it was a little surprising that the show took off the way it did. It you know, it became this enormous monster hit, like, in the first month. And I, you know, and all the reviews were just raves about it. We had one negative review, and that guy wrote a review 2 months later taking back his negative review. He said, you know, I've watched this since I, you know, when I first reviewed this, I really didn't, you know, like, I must have been in a bad mood or something. I think this show's really brilliant. So we literally had like 100% positive reviews, and I always felt like, well, people are, you know, the people are a little starved for shows right now or something. You know, it's like, I felt like reviewers were giving it too much of a benefit of the doubt. And then 5 years passed, 6 years passed, and I watched some of those first season shows again, and I'm so proud of them. I think they're so good. They make me laugh now because I haven't been working on it and trying to fix the things I didn't have time to fix yet.
It's like pointillism. I think when you're working on something creative, if you're too close to it, it just looks like a bunch of dots. And
yes,
then you just got to like have some perspective and take some space,
yeah,
before seeing,
exactly,
what you've made.
Yeah. It's a lot of just hearing it over and over and over again. And you know, now when I watch the show, I will laugh out loud. I'll be surprised by stuff that I wrote. Like, oh, I remember writing that gag, but I still didn't see it coming because I've forgotten about that, you know?
So I used to do a lot of theater and sketch comedy on stage. And there was this phenomenon of like a rehearsal high. We would rehearse. And then an actor would do something dumb. Everyone would laugh. And we would be like, this is brilliant. And then we would put it up on stage that night.
And it would die.
And I couldn't figure out why. And it was like, of course, human beings are literally wired to laugh at surprise, to laugh,
yes,
at incongruence. So when you're an actor,
yeah, that,
you know,
stuff is surprising you because you've heard it one way all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what all of show running is like on a comedy show, you're basically doing forensic comedy. You're trying to figure out why this gag died. This gag was funny when we originally pitched it, and now it's not funny in the script. Why is that? Can we fix it?
And also, like, so serious. Like, it's no one,
yes,
is laughing. It's like,
yes,
this joke didn't work. What could it be? Well, it might be because we said fart, you know, fart. Not funny there because the consonants aren't funny.
We have those kind of conversations all the time. And there's so many times at which in the process of animation that joke can die. And you're constantly trying to breathe life back into it. And then, like, it'll come back, you know, 6 months later from overseas in color, and it won't be funny. Oh, is it the timing? Is it the animation? Is it the joke? It just was never that funny.
Mm-hmm.
Is it that it needs to be rewritten? Is it needs to be reanimated? You know, like, there's all these different ways you can try to fix that joke. And sometimes it's like, is it just that we've seen it too many times?
Mm-hmm.
The first time we did a movie, Phineas and Ferb Across the Second Dimension movie, I had seen every frame of that movie so many times. And by the time we were done with it, I was literally like, I think it's all funny. None of it reads as funny to me anymore. I hope that there's still laughs in this. I haven't changed these gags since I got them to work in color, and I've seen them too many times now. I hope it's funny. And then Swampy and I sat in the back of a huge theater for our preview screening at Comic-Con, and every single joke got a big laugh. It was so great to hear that and realize, okay, good, good. We're just able to relax. It's, you know, comedy is hard.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
You've talked about how originally you wanted to work in live action.
Yeah, originally that's what I came out here to do, was go into live action. And that's what I was putting a lot of energy towards. But at the same time, I was making money doing cartooning at the newspaper at USC, and it sort of turned me into a cartoonist. And then I started getting work in cartooning. And then in the same week, I got hired to write a low-budget slasher movie, and I got hired to draw on The Simpsons. And I was going to the Simpsons every day till all day long, and absorbing, learning how to draw animation in a studio setting, which was thrilling and great and sort of overwhelming. And then I would come home at night, and I would have dinner, and then I would write till 11 o'clock or something like that, and after 2 weeks I had a first draft done and turned it in, and I was told that I could probably direct it, but I would only get paid $5,000 or something like that. And I was like, I think I'm getting the same kind of creative rocks off doing exactly the same stuff that I wanted to do in live action, but with more control over it when I drew. Mm-hmm. And I realized also that I liked everybody I worked with. Mm-hmm. Whereas, the people I'd worked with in live action, there weren't as many of them that I would want to go have lunch with. It's like I didn't really enjoy the live action parties that I would go to. I mean, it was still fun to sort of work the room and sort of, meet people and stuff. But it wasn't just a party of people hanging out and just wanting to talk and have fun. And I was like, I think this may be my peeps. I think animation is my peeps. I think I need to stay here. And that's what I did.
Well, that's sort of what is talked about in the industry, right? That people in animation are just tend to be really nice, or yes. Like at least it's a kinder subsection of Hollywood,
yes,
than live action. And I've always wondered why that is.
I think here's the real thing that makes it different. People who can't draw don't think they can draw. There's nobody who says, oh, I could storyboard if I wanted to.
Yeah, no.
You know what I mean? People either can or they can't. So there's not this desperation to prove that you can do something that other people think they can do. But everybody thinks they could write.
Everyone.
Everybody thinks they could direct.
Everyone.
Everybody thinks that that's something that they could do if they just sat down and did it. You know, and which is not true. But that is the perception by the people that you're trying to get to hire you, is that they could do what you do.
And there's this accessibility, right? So it's like, I'm able to do this versus something that takes a very particular skill.
Yes.
This is a skill that is so much less accessible.
Yes. Like people who don't draw don't think, oh, if I were to try to draw, I could draw. Because most of them have tried to draw and failed. So they understand how hard it is. And so when you get to that level where you realize, oh, I've got this skill that everybody else doesn't have, the people who are sort of the stars in an animated show are often the artists. And they don't have the same kind of insecurity about it. You don't have as much of that imposter syndrome and things like that, because you can look and, oh, I can do this. And not everybody can do this. So I'm a commodity that people will pay me to do.
So you also voice characters.
I do Dr. Doofenshmirtz, and I did Vinny Dakota for Milo Murphy's Law. which are sort of opposites. Doofenshmirtz is way up here, and Vinny's way down here like this, so.
What made you want to voice that character that way?
I was writing the first Doofenshmirtz dialogue, which were, ah, Patty the Platypus, what an unexpected surprise. And by unexpected, of course, I mean completely expected! And which became this running joke through the whole series. And it made me laugh, but I couldn't tell if it was funny. And so I pitched it the next morning to my wife, because she was asleep when I was working on it. And she laughed. And I just used that voice when I did it. So I pitched it like that to the executives. And one of them was like, I think maybe you should do the voice. And I was like, I would do that. I think that would be fun. And he became this thing. It's, you know, it's like he's had a bunch of viral videos on TikTok that I had nothing to do with, that, you know, where they take a song he's done or a line he's done and it becomes a trend on TikTok. And, you know, it's like literally millions and millions and millions of videos with that voice in it.
I mean, it's become a character beyond yourself.
Yeah.
I remember when Lil Nas posted a video and it was like the moment I realized I was gay.
Was when he saw Doofenshmirtz.
Doofenshmirtz. sex icon. Who would have thought?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. I think that I said, oh, glad I could be of assistance or something like that. I commented like that. And at least one person said they unfollowed me because of that. And I was like, well, good riddance.
Bye.
Yeah, bye. That's okay. I can do without you.
And there's literally like walk around characters at Epcot.
There's not actually a walk around of Doof. There's walk arounds of Phineas and Ferb and Perry. There's a big wooden sculpture of Doof that comes out of a Glockenspiel at Epcot. He's like 5 feet tall and he's like running from like somebody. It comes out of this clock, which is a cool thing. And I'm hoping when they eventually retire that attraction, which I think they will at some point, I would love to have that in my, you know, in my yard or something, or, you know, or in my office. I could just have him here in the corner.
Just a little friend.
The coolest thing was they did a dance party, a Phineas and Ferb dance party over in California Adventure, where the walking characters, the Phineas and Ferb came out with all these girls dressed as Fireside Girls dancing and leading the audience in these dances. And people would line up ahead of time to see that, and they would come dressed as characters and stuff like that. That was probably the coolest thing that's happened to me, maybe ever, is seeing that happen at one of the parks. That was really,
I won't
really
tell cool. Your wife or your children.
Oh, they know. I've been very clear to them about that. I've been like, you know, it was nice when you guys were born, but nowhere near as cool as this thing. It's like, you guys will always be second. That's what I always tell them.
No. So you're married to a Venezuelan. Your kids are Venezuelan / American. They're hyphenated.
Yes,
and
they
a lot of Latinos don't know this, and they get incredibly excited.
There's a bunch of videos now because I reposted that the fridge video with that I did with Carolina Ravassa.
So the fridge video is this TikTok where you sort of have this funny movement with a person that pretends to be your wife, and then your real wife comes out, and it's Clarissa.
Yes, but because Clarissa has a very Venezuelan accent, a lot of people asked me if she was Venezuelan, and I said, oh yeah, she's from Caracas. And so many Venezuelans have now put up videos about the fact that I'm married to somebody from Caracas, which they love, which I think is really sweet.
It's very funny because you also recently posted a video of your family reunion where everyone's talking in Spanish, and obviously it's a Venezuelan accent, and people just tag me in it. And it's like, is this your family? Because you work with him? Did he go to your family? And I'm like, no.
Like, no, he also has a Venezuelan family. It's like most of my family is Venezuelan. I'm the one gringo.
Has that part of your life like influenced you or your work at all?
I mean, it really has on this show, but you know, it's like Isabella in Phineas and Ferb was Isabella Garcia Shapiro, because I wanted her to be half Latin and, you know, so she's Mexican and Jewish. And the whole family in the new show is sort of based on my family. It's a blended family. The dad, who looks very much like me.
Literally, I think it's, looks exactly.
I think it looks exactly like me, and the mom looks basically like Clarissa. But what's funny is that I'm not doing that voice. It would have probably made sense if I had done that voice, but we got Matt, and he's so good. I was like, no, I'd rather have him do it. And the kids, you know, like there's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed kid, because I've got a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Venezuelan child, and there's a kid who has darker hair and looks more stereotypical Latin. But, you know, it was fun to just sort of use that and not make it be about that, but make that be sort of the flavor in the background of the show. We did a lot of work. I think you sat with Dorothea, our art director, and made sure that their apartment looked like it was decorated by somebody who is from Venezuela.
There's a lot of little Easter eggs in the house
There's a picture of the Avila on the, mm-hmm.
the art,
lawn.
Just all like, these little details definitely make it feel authentic. You know, when we were casting the mom who is Venezuelan, I won't reveal who we cast since this is all, you know. But the person that we cast, she came in and did the lines in a way that I was just like, it has to be this person.
Yeah.
And then it was revealed.
Yes, that she was doing an impersonation of your mom from your Instagrams.
So she she did her research. She was like, okay.
Well, Joe is involved in this. I should go check out her videos.
She's Venezuelan. She probably wants someone that sounds like her mom. And it literally sounds very much like my mom.
Yes.
And, you know, I wrote this abuela character.
Yes.
And the abuela character, I worked with a character designer, and I sent her pictures of my Cuban grandma, and it is the exact version. It's my grandma in animated. Like,
well, what I love about that character is it doesn't look like the typical abuela that you would see in Coco or Encanto or anything. You know, there's this version of abuela, which is like a 40-year-old abuela that they remember, which is from a different generation, stuff like that. But abuelas now look much more modern. And, you know, it's like they were people who were born like when I was, you know, when I was born in the 60s, you know, like late 50s and 60s. And they don't dress like they're from the old country and stuff like that. And that's what I love about Gretel and Kevin's abuela in the show. Is she looks like so many Venezuelan women that I know.
And it was an effortless episode to write because it really did come from experience and like people I knew and loved. And it stories are just so much easier to write when you feel something. And we were thinking about cast. I was like, it has to be Jenny, my co-host on the podcast. And she absolutely knocked it out of the park. She sounds exactly like my grandma, who was Cuban.
It was so great. Yeah, it's so great. It's so great.
People say, what does diversity in entertainment mean? And I think it's like, if you have people in the room who are that thing and have the emotional connection and that feeling with a particular culture or people in their life, they're going to want to write about it.
Exactly.
Or filter the story through their perspective and point of view. And that was, I think, my favorite episode to write because it just felt so much like my real life.
Yeah.
Even though there's an enormous, huge villain that looks like
a giant baby.
Yeah, a giant baby. But anyway, Dan, before we leave, you know, I feel like the voice of Doofenshmirtz is the voice of Doofenshmirtz. And I feel like we got to say a goodbye in the voice of Doofenshmirtz.
This has been Hyphenated, the show about living in the hyphen. So go hyphenate yourself.
Brilliant. Brilliant. They won't notice it's not Jenny.
Yes.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us. Now we have an actual meeting for work where we have to figure out like 200 more episodes of the show.
And we're late for it.
So. And we're late for it. Okay. Bye, Dan.
Ciao. Bye.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.